You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
That struck me by surprise that he wanted to become a professional actor. And neither, of course, a revolutionary nor an engineer.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Now, what do you think of when you hear the name Leonid Brezhnev, who ruled the Soviet Union for 18 years from the 1960s to the 1980s? An old guy, waving weakly from the Lenin Mausoleum? Well, think again. We speak with Susanna Schattenberg, the author of a new biography which systematically dismantles the stereotypical and one-dimensional view of Brezhnev as the stagnating Stalinist, by drawing on a wealth of archival research and documents not previously studied in English. The Brezhnev that emerges is a complex one, from his early apolitical years as an aspiring actor and poetry fan, through to his swift and surprising rise through the party ranks. We talk about his hitherto misunderstood role in Khrushchev's ousting and appointment as his successor, to his somewhat pro-Western foreign policy aims, deft consolidation and management of power, and ultimate descent into addiction and untimely death. For Susanna, this is the story of a flawed and ineffectual idealist. For the West, this biography makes a convincing case that Brezhnev should be reappraised as one of the most interesting and important political figures of the 20th century. Time doesn't come free, and I'm asking listeners to support my work recording these incredible stories via a small or large donation. If you become a monthly supporter via Patreon, you will get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Still not sure? Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Susanna Schattenberg to our Cold War conversation.
It's very interesting because not a lot of documents are really available, and that is why I went to his hometown, which was then Kamianskoye in Ukraine. So we know that he was from Russian background. His parents came to Ukraine because they were searching for work. So he's obviously from poor working class background. But to my surprise, they were not at all interested in revolution or in the Bolsheviks. And they were quite normal people. And of course, they were religious people, praying and having icons of the Orthodox saints in their very small apartment. And they were rather interested in moving upward by giving their son a very good education, which is quite unusual and rare for that time. That Brezhnev indeed attended a secondary school, which was normally not affordable to normal, ordinary working children. So he had a quite happy childhood, as he said himself later, and the revolution and the civil war rather destroyed this very happy small world he lived in. And what is very interesting and nearly funny to me is that his later official Soviet biographers had, of course, problems in fashioning a real revolutionary career out of this a very ordinary childhood and really had problems in bringing his parents near to the Bolsheviks. Then they said that they allegedly welcomed the revolution, but there is no sign for it. And rather, the Brezhnevs lived through a very hard time, and Brezhnev himself nearly died from illness during this time, and he was happy to survive this period.
His early years are unusual for some of the party leaders, but as you say, they with any biography created during Soviet times, they try to insert this revolutionary story there, and with Brezhnev, there obviously wasn't much there. And in fact, he was, I understand he was interested in being an amateur actor, and he had a passion for poetry as well.
That's right. And that struck me by surprise that he wanted to become a professional actor, and neither, of course, a revolutionary nor an engineer, what he became indeed later, and what was the favorite profession in the 1920s and 30s. And so he started play acting not only in an amateur's acting group in the early 1920s, by the way, together with his two siblings, his brother and his sister, but also later in the 1920s when he started studying, he earned his living as an extra in the theater there. And this is like a red line through his whole life. He later in the 1960s, 70s, when he was already general secretary of the party, he told his aides and his friends and comrades how much he would have loved to become an actor. And he really liked still then in the evening to, when they sat together, he would stand up on a chair and read by heart his famous poets like Sergei Yesenin.
Wow, that certainly does bring a different side to him there. How was his later education? He went to agricultural college, I think.
Yes. Let me start with a very ordinary job he took just after the Civil War. He worked just as somebody unloading trucks in a factory, and that for nearly 4 years, because there was no different choice and he just had to make money. And that is also very interesting, because this, of course, was kept secret by his official biographers, because this was a kind of activity that was not revolutionary at all. But then he took the chance and joined this college for agriculture, and he graduated as a land surveyor. And that was in very difficult times, because he graduated in 1927, and in 1928 already the collectivization of the countryside and the decolonization began. So Brezhnev, although he was not at all in favor of the Bolsheviks and revolution, he had to fulfill the government policy and to measure the land that was taken by peasants and given to the collective farms. And that is obviously why he finally really fled from the countryside. So he tried to escape the situation of growing violence in the countryside. And he took flight to Moscow in 1930 and tried there to enroll at the university, but left already after only 1 month because he could not find even a room for him and his wife and his little daughter. So, and this is already the second flight or escape he took which of course both were kept secret by the official stories later on the famous General Secretary Brezhnev. And only then, 1 year later, he started studying and enrolled in again in Ukraine at an institute for engineering, which he really then finished in 1935 as an engineer.
When did he actually join the party? He was quite, excuse the pun, late to the party, I think.
Yes, right. So this was only due to the type of occupation he then had. So while still working as a land surveyor, he had to take more responsibility on a Soviet level, and these administrative jobs were only given to those who were party members. And as he was at that time not a worker anymore, but as a land surveyor, so-called white-collar worker, he had to wait 2 years from his application for joining the party in 1928 to his full establishment as party member in 1930, which was really late. So normally, young enthusiasts joined the party right after the revolution, or at least in the early 1920s.
I'm presuming his Soviet biographers managed to avoid that piece of information as well.
Yes.
How did he fare during the 1930s? Was it quite a rapid rise?
In the early 1930s, there are no signs that he would become later the general secretary of the Communist Party. Rather, his career was quite usual, at least in for those who joined finally the party. And of course, even as student, he again was confronted with decolonization and collectivization of the countryside. So he could not evade being sent again to the countryside and help to enforce government politics against the peasants. And also he took quite early responsibility. So during his time as a student, so he studied only in the evening, while during the day he was still working and he was leading a workers' faculty, preparing workers for their later studies. So we see here quite a lot of responsibilities, but not necessarily anything that would have led to this high career he took then after 1937. And we also see that he tried as much as he managed to enjoy life. So he went hunting, he loved dancing. After completing his study and serving his military service in 1936, he was appointed again director of a college, of a technical college, and there also he established circles for dancing and acting. So every spare time, which a good communist is supposed to spend for the party, he spent indeed dancing and hunting.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And we're talking sort of towards the late 1930s, which is when Stalin's purges were at their height. He obviously avoided the ultimate price of being involved in those purges, but how close did he come to being arrested?
Yes, he came quite close. Although to establish this exactly how much he was threatened by immediate arrest still remains unclear because of the lack of sources. But because there were so many arrests, he was promoted first to the city administration of Dnepr-Dzerzhinsk, so still his hometown, and then even to the party bureau of his hometown. And what was most striking to me that I could find the minutes from the sessions, party bureau sessions in November 37, when they were talking about excluding other party members from the party and having them arrested as enemies of the people. And in this minutes, you can see how much Brezhnev struggled to avoid anything that would threaten or endanger his colleagues, and how much he tried to fashion himself as a very naive and unexperienced person who just by coincidence had to work with these alleged enemies of the people. And you see how much he tries to bring the attention back to the real problems, like renovating buildings or building tramway rails, etc. So this is very interesting, because there was not a lot of choice how to behave, or rather how to speak in such sessions. And he really tries to avoid the discourse of party enemies, which have to be unveiled and which have to be excluded and arrested. And there's only some evidence, but not from archival documents, that he himself was threatened by arrest, because as the director of this technical college, he had added a third floor to the building without asking the party officials. But we don't know if really there was a serious threat to him. So later in his party documents, he wrote that he was never under suspicion and never under arrest. But we see how much he struggled, and also how much he suffered, because very close persons to him, those who had supported him during his studies, and even neighbors, people with whom he went hunting, were arrested and shot at that time.
Yeah, that's some really good insight into the dangers of those times, even for those that were in party. In 1941, Germany invades the Soviet Union. What's his war record like?
On the one hand, he had never really great responsibility, or he was neither fighting with a gun in his hand at the front, nor was he really a commander who had to lead the troops. But nevertheless, he was responsible for getting evacuated the town he was living and working at that time, which was already Dnepropetrovsk, so the bigger regional center. And also we see how close he comes to the front. And all the time he is a politkommissar, so the political leader or the political assistant of the officers, who is responsible for the strength, the moral strength of the troops. He, after the war, described to colleagues how much he was terrified, especially in his first months of the war, how close he was under fire and bombing, and how much he feared for his life. So later, the official propaganda made of him a war hero, which he never was, absolutely not. And they even invented a lot of episodes. But we absolutely have to face that the war had such an impact on Brezhnev that he decided that it's the most terrible thing under which people suffer, and that he has to avoid for any price another war. So he was really deeply trembled and shocked by the severeness and brutalness of the war. And at the end, he said or wrote, when there were rumors they might be sent to Paris for some negotiations, that he didn't want to go there. He wanted just to go home. And he said how much he hated all of this and the war. And he rather would spit on Paris than to go there.
That's a great quote. But during the war, he meets somebody who is going to be of significant importance towards his rise to being general secretary.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Yes, that's correct. He meets Khrushchev, although he certainly met him already in 1938, and Khrushchev became first secretary of Ukraine. But they meet again during the war, and obviously Khrushchev was quite impressed by Brezhnev, who, by the way, was obviously quite good looking. And that is not so trivial as it may sound, but this young, handsome man impresses, obviously, also by his look, people like first Khrushchev and later even Stalin and other persons. And Khrushchev is then responsible for Brezhnev's career after the war, because after 45, Brezhnev, as many other officers, stays in the military, although he would love to come home and get back to a civil life. Although this is interesting also that from 45 to 46, so he is responsible for Sovietizing the Carpathians, which were taken from Czechoslovakia and made a part of Ukraine. So here he has the first experience, although still a military person, as some kind of governor, how to restructure a whole region and implement Soviet administration. But Khrushchev is the one who asked Stalin to send Brezhnev back to Ukraine. And that happens then in 1947, where he first becomes first secretary of his, not really hometown, but the town where he worked before the war, Dniepropetrovsk, then is sent from there, also on the plea of Khrushchev, to Moldova, to govern already a whole republic and Sovietize it, because Moldova was, until the war, part of Romania and was occupied and annexed by the Soviet Union only during the war.
When Stalin dies and Khrushchev becomes general secretary, Brezhnev and Khrushchev become quite a close-knit team, I understand.
In the higher party circles, there is still a quite severe power struggle going on, and Khrushchev uses Brezhnev for fortifying his troops, so to say, and as a person he can use and send into important provinces as a counterpart to those clients of his rivals. And so he sends Brezhnev to Kazakhstan, where at that time the very important agricultural reform is taking place. So this is the Virgin Land campaign, where the party is propagating that they may grow maize and corn out of the poor desert or steppe. And so he sends Brezhnev to Kazakhstan, where he is only second secretary, soon becomes first secretary, so head of the republic, and he's really responsible for implementing this huge agricultural reform in this desert-like republic in Central Asia. And I had the impression from the archive there that this is also very crucial for his further development, because he sees in which poverty people are living, that they really live with nothing. And when they write about farm or the cattle and all that, there's really nothing. They live in the poor sand, and the buildings are only made by mud. And I think Brezhnev is really frustrated and shocked by the situation people live in. And he is really somebody who travels around the country the whole time and tries to help. And he does this up to his total exhaustion. So here is the first time that he breaks down and collapses with a first and only heart attack at a quite a young age of 45, 46 years only.
That's sort of first signs of future health problems.
Right.
But the relationship between him and Khrushchev breaks down in later years, doesn't it?
Khrushchev calls him to Moscow in 1956, where he makes him a real powerful secretary of the party for the armament industry. Khrushchev makes him head of the presidium of the Supreme Council of the country, which is to us the president and highest person in the state. And Brezhnev enjoys a lot traveling the world, at least through Africa and Asia. And why the relationship between Brezhnev and Khrushchev is shattering and deteriorating is not so easy to say. It seems it's more due to Khrushchev's behavior, and that he is developing to which a person acts totally independent.
With Khrushchev, he's sort of baiting and ridiculing fellow members of the Politburo, and he's riding roughshod over collective leadership. He wants to take all the decisions himself.
That is what he does with Brezhnev. So he took advantage of earlier that Brezhnev was supporting him without asking and without any hesitance. He's now ridiculing and saying that Brezhnev is only a phrasemonger, somebody without his own mind. And he even takes ousts Brezhnev from the post of the president of the Soviet Union, what Brezhnev takes very personally. And so the overall situation in the Politburo is that they are afraid personally of Khrushchev, that they see that he is damaging the country outside, for example, the Cuba crisis, and inside because there are first unrest which had to be suppressed with arms, even because of rising prices for meat and food. But there's a third very important point, and that is that Khrushchev is telling them that the Politburo itself is only a bunch of old, useless men, and that he is going to release it soon. And this, of course, frightens and alerts the Politburo, because they don't want at all to lose their posts. And that is the situation that they decide that they have to act and have to get rid of Khrushchev. So it's rather because of their own posts and their own career than because they are concerned about the image of the Soviet Union in the outer world.
Dear listener, we have a book giveaway with this episode, so do make sure you check out the episode notes for how to enter. Best of luck. Now, back to the episode. When Brezhnev comes to power, his style is very different to Khrushchev's leadership style. He's very familiar with his colleagues, stays in close contact with them. And also, coming back to your mention about him being shocked by the poverty in the Soviet Union in previous years that he's seen, he brings in some reforms around pensions, for example, doesn't he?
I argue that Brezhnev is very much led in his politics toward the Politburo by the two put against Khrushchev, so the first failed one and then the second successful one. So he is well aware that the Politburo, and not only the Politburo, but also the Central Committee, could at any time raise against the General Secretary, that is himself, and oust him. And so the first thing he cares about is that nobody will be felt threatened by him, that everybody sees him as a close friend that doesn't put a threat or menace to anybody. And that is why he is often seen or described as such a nice guy without a clear program, without that kind of leadership we see in Khrushchev or Stalin. But I have the impression, and at some point he said this to a comrade, that people, at least after this enormous terror under Stalin, and of course the devastating Second World War, and after the still very furious, very disturbing years under Khrushchev, at least everybody shall settle in peace and just enjoy life, a little bit of well-being. And of course, these programs of raising wages and pensions is a continuation from Khrushchev's time, who already began with these kind of reforms. Also, the call to build apartment, that at least every family has her own apartment, is something Khrushchev already introduced and he reinforces. So this welfare program, or the plan to really build a welfare state, is something he has in mind and which has always been overlooked by a lot of other historians and politicians.
In 1968, he's facing his first major international crisis with the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia. And Alexander Dubček, who's the leader of Czechoslovakia at the time, is a protege of Brezhnev.
This was also very striking and curious to me, first to find that in the very beginning, Brezhnev supported Dubček and obviously thought him to be something like a Czechoslovakian Brezhnev. So just a young party leader, a promising person who is just trying to modernize a little bit the state, but not necessarily reform or even abolish the party. And until the very end, that means until mid of August, he really tries to support him, even to defend him against his colleagues in the Politburo and the more against the party leaders from the other brother states, who are really frightened and alert about the situation in Czechoslovakia, where censorship is abolished and the media may print and say everything what they want, and where people are calling for leaving the Warsaw Pact and for making the Soviet Union responsible for all the crimes that has been committed under socialism. And it's only in the end that Brezhnev agrees to send troops when he realizes that Dubček no more defends the Communist Party, but is telling him that at the next party congress he will resign and probably the party will be released at all. And this is the red line here, that Brezhnev is not prepared to accept that Czechoslovakia will leave the socialist bloc. But they have a situation when they meet to negotiate, and Brezhnev tries for last time to convince Dubček to get rid of all the, how he says, counter-revolutionary persons and appoint reliable forces, that Brezhnev becomes ill. And it's interesting because Dubček believed that Brezhnev is just playing and pretending to be ill, but indeed he has headaches and problems with his stomachs, etc. And that is the second time that we see how weak he is physically and how much stress deteriorates his health. And at that time, that is what his doctors later said, he begins to increase his daily doses of sleeping pills and tranquilizers, which he is taking already since Stalin's time. But now he is taking more and more, which will then lead to his pill addiction in the mid of the 1970s.
Yes, yes. In the 1970s, Brezhnev is trying to portray himself almost like a Western statesman. And you describe his attempts to sort of build a big four, similar to the big three during World War II of Roosevelt, Churchill and Stalin. With Brezhnev, he's looking to build the big four, which is him, Willy Brandt in West Germany, Richard Nixon, who's the US president at the time, and Georges Pompidou, who's the French president.
And that is really interesting, because maybe it's just an anecdote, but Brezhnev thinks always of the big four during wartime, neglecting that they were not four because there was no French president at that time. And when he writes to...
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
To Pompidou, that 25 years after Potsdam, they have to reunite and rethink Europe. Pompidou writes on the letter, we weren't there, but then crosses this out and doesn't correct Brezhnev. Obviously, it's not important enough to him. But nevertheless, it's really what Brezhnev wants to do, and the reference to the war is important to him. It's important to him. So he is really seeking for an durable peace and for a long-lasting, peaceful coexistence, first in Europe and then also with the USA. That is interesting because for a long time there were always prejudices saying that Brezhnev or the Soviet Union were just pretending to want peace. But indeed, all statesmen with whom he is dealing and who he's meeting and having four eyes talks, they all confirm that Brezhnev was really serious about having peace and that he really loved peace. And what is surprising that he uses his acting talent to get into the role of the Western statement. I can't tell how much this is conscious or unconscious, but he has a good awareness how the Soviet Union is perceived in the West as the evil, as the other, as a communist. And he understands that he has to circumvent these prejudices and present himself in a way that is, that he's read like a Western statesman or perceived like just a man, as every man in the West. And he uses different means for this. So the first thing is that he tries to meet all the other leaders personally. So first Brandt, then Pompidou, and finally Nixon. And he tries to be alone with them, only with an interpreter and without all the other officials. And he makes joke with them, even anti-communist jokes, just to convince them he's not an ideologue, but he's really just a person like them, they themselves. And even with his clothing, he tries to show that he's a Western statesman, and he has a weakness for clothing, and since his youth time already, and these are really things that are noticed by Nixon, also by Henry Kissinger, by Pompidou and Brandt. Sometimes they don't understand what Brezhnev is doing, or they think he's very Russian in being so close and touchy and very sanguine, how they call it, and very southern, extroverted, like he behaves. But nevertheless, they understand that he tries to impress them in a good way. And this obviously leads to a situation where they begin to trust him. And on this ground of trust, it's possible then to conclude and sign contracts.
Yeah, and this is known as détente. And in the book, there's some great photos of Brezhnev during this period. The one I particularly like is the one that was said to be his favorite because he felt that he looked like Alain Delon, who was a very famous French film star at the time.
So this is also fascinating about Brezhnev. He's the first Soviet party leader at all who has or hires his own photographer. Of course, this is not a personal photographer, but he's working for TASS, the Soviet press agency. But he is advising Brezhnev which photos to take and to print, and here especially which photo to send to the French press to prepare this, the French people for the visit Brezhnev plans in October 71. And so he decides to take that picture where he's on board of a motor yacht in front of Crimea, and really with sunglasses and then a white t-shirt. And he's comparing himself to Alain Delon. And obviously he thinks that is something, a photograph French people will understand and like.
Yeah, and he is trying to portray himself as this virile, active man. He's got a fondness for fast cars as well. And he's trying to portray himself as we've said earlier, as a Western statesman. But the latter half of the 1970s start to see his addiction taking hold and a decline in his health.
The problem is that the first 4 or 5 years, his plan and strategy work quite well. And he's on really good terms with the three statesmen. And then in only a few months, in spring, summers of 1974, all three resign or die. And Brezhnev is really shocked and totally frustrated because he sees that all his efforts to gain trust, to build trust, and to get close to these statesmen have been in vain. And feverishly, he really tries within only some weeks to get contact, personal contacts to the followers. So to Helmut Schmidt in Bonn, and to Valéry Giscard d'Estaing in Paris, and to Gerald Ford, who even comes to Vladivostok to meet Brezhnev. But obviously, he is too much under stress. So he's taking a lot of pills at that time, which is really a disaster because he takes pills to sleep at night, and then he can't wake up in the morning, and to calm down, he takes tranquilizers, and then he can't be woken up by his aides after the afternoon nap, which really causes scandals when he makes Giscard d'Estaing wait for him for several hours, which can't be explained. And he collapses in Vladivostok, which can be hide, but only with difficulties in front of Gerald Ford. But then the beginning of 1975, he just vanishes from the international scene, and observers in the West are asking what is going on. And of course, nobody had the idea that Brezhnev is probably just, or we know he's in a rehab, and tries to get rid of the pill addiction. And that is something which really is hampering him from acting freely from this point until his very death, that he has sometimes clear moments when he's able to act, and then again for weeks and months he is just under the influence of pills and is not able to even talk in the end. And that is why his aides and colleagues try to surround him permanently by not only interpreters, but doctors and other persons who may intervene in case Brezhnev loses control or just falls. And that is what the world is observing and noticing, that he's not able to speak anymore. Every answer he has to be given on a paper sheet, and the own population begins to joke that he's not able to say a single word without a sheet. And that is really a disaster. And the end of his detente, because the West has no idea of his faltering health, or rather they see that the house is in very bad condition, but they don't suspect here an addiction. And of course, Brezhnev and the Soviet Union doesn't tell this to the world. And so the retreat of Brezhnev is interpreted in the West as a change of course in the Politburo toward a more aggressive relation toward the West. And this is how everything he started in 1969 ends, and at the end in a catastrophe with the invasion in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and that was a question I was going to ask you. How much was he involved in that decision to invade Afghanistan, do you think?
Obviously, or we know that nearly for sure from the documents, he was not involved in this decision. Although he was informed during the time from a special commission, which was built by the Politburo to care about the situation in A, like the document says. And what was spoken and what kind of oral exchange they had, we, of course, don't know. But all his aides and colleagues say that at that time, in the end of 79, Brezhnev was in really bad shape. And that is why he was not involved in the decision-making and just informed after the invasion that they had crossed with the army the border to Afghanistan in late December 79. Nevertheless, the time before, since the Afghan revolution in early 78, he had a lot of contact with the party leaders in Afghanistan who were all the time asking for support, for military support, and they really asked what was never believed in the West. They indeed asked for military support and that the Soviet Union sent troops, what they always rejected very seriously, because there was a great analysis in the Politburo that if they sent troops to Afghanistan, this would end all attempts for a new detente that was would totally destroy the image of the Soviet Union inside and outside of the Soviet Union. There would be no means then to renew the contact to Western statesmen. And although they had this brilliant analysis, they finally nevertheless invaded Afghanistan, and it came as they had previewed themselves. So this was a total catastrophe.
And with Poland in 1981, with the threat of invasion there, was that one of Brezhnev's more lucid times? Because it appears from the book that he was involved more in the decision-making around that.
Yes. At least this is my impression, that he gets more involved at that time. And obviously the doctors had managed to at least control the amount of pills Brezhnev was taking. So later, his grandsons were complaining that the doctors never managed to really free Brezhnev of this addiction, but they said there was no way to do this. The only way was to have a control on the amount. And Brezhnev was starting to do sports, to go swimming regularly, to have walks regularly. So there, he's in a better shape at that time. And I also got the impression from the disaster with Afghanistan, he tries with all means to avoid a second disaster in Poland. And so it's very clear to the Politburo that whatever will happen, they will not invade there. And that is what they tell Jaruzelski, the Polish prime minister and defense minister, and also first secretary of the party, so he has all three posts, that they have to care about their mess on their own, which is quite funny that the Poles are understanding the situation and they say, okay, if we do have to impose martial law by ourselves, so you have at least to help us materially. And they are calling for a lot of support, like oil and gas and food, etc. And the Soviet Union sees no other way than to send all this support to evade situation where they would send troops.
And you can definitely argue that the rise of solidarity and the declaration of martial law was the beginning of the end for the Soviet Union and the Cold War. And we have further information such as videos and links in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Now, you wouldn't be listening to this podcast without the generous support of our patrons. However, I want to especially thank our Politburo level members who are contributing a generous $30 a month to keep us on the air. They are Tony Sowards, Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, Mark Labance, Jeffrey Jones, Matthew Comstock, Frederick Esposito, Jack Madwed, Todd Lemieux, and Peter Ryan. Don't forget, if you like one of those Cold War Conversations coasters and help support the show, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, please visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.